I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my day. And what
Patricia T. O'Connor is here, author of four or five, and now updated. Anyway,
five.
Many books on the language.
Yes, five.
You count Woe Is I,
Woe
the
Is
updated,
I Junior.
You're not counting the new updated version that just
I'm counting that as one book. But It is in a third edition now, just out.
And when Patricia comes to our show, we take your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can send us a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You can start dialing right now because we're going to get to the calls fairly soon. But you wanted to talk about egg creams?
Well, I wanted to talk about egg creams because I had a very interesting question from someone who grew up working in a candy store and soda fountain in Brooklyn. And he says, I started making egg creams at age 3 while standing on the ice cream freezer in the store and reaching over to the fountain handles. There was no egg in our egg cream. So why is an egg cream called an egg cream? So I looked into this, and it seems that the modern incarnation of the egg cream has neither egg nor cream. It has chocolate syrup, seltzer, and milk. But there's a theory that the egg is actually a corruption of the Yiddish word echt, meaning genuine or real, so that an egg cream is the real article or whatever. But there's other evidence that the original egg creams may actually have had egg and cream in them.
And from what I remember reading, there was a concern that poor kids, immigrant children, weren't getting enough protein. And also there was a belief that eating a raw egg was a good idea. So this was a way to get the kids to eat something good.
And actually, egg cream authorities...
But they didn't have Fox's You Bet at the time.
No, they didn't. They made their own chocolate syrup. And egg cream authorities say that the inventor, Louis Oster... Now, I don't know if he's a relation to Paul Oster. My husband thought he had heard that at one time. But it would make him his great-great-grandson. But at any rate, Louis Oster, who in the 1890s opened the first of the family's soda fountains on the Lower East Side, his son Emmanuel once said that egg and cream were actually added to the chocolate syrup, which would make sense of something else I once read, that in the old days before commercial chocolate syrups, the chocolate syrup only could keep for about 2 days.
Wow.
And they had to throw it out, and that would make sense if it had real cream and real raw egg in it. But at any rate, he said that egg cream, pure cream and eggs proportioned in a batch of syrup, not an egg to each glass, was 3 cents. He wrote this in a letter to the editor of the New York Herald Tribune in the 60s. So the evidence does show that some early recipes actually had both.
Still love them, that they're disappearing. Nobody makes a good egg cream anymore.
Yeah, that's what I hear. There are a lot of people out there mourning the old days of the where you could get a good egg cream at almost any soda fountain. And now I'm not sure who says that you can get a good one.
And there were debates as how to put the seltzer into it, whether you did it on the back of a spoon or whether you did it directly in and foamed it up.
Yes, most of the people who've actually done it say that you fill a glass a third of the way with milk, gently stir in the chocolate syrup, then put the spoon up, raise the spoon up, and aim the seltzer on the spoon so that it bounces off the spoon and into the chocolate milk mixture. And you get a nice head. So that would seem to make sense.
Should we get to some of our callers and comments? One listener wrote in wondering about a thing that had happened on the show recently where this woman pronounced the word O-F-T-E-N often, many times.
Uh-huh.
And I, because she was talking about how correctly she spoke, and we were wondering about often and often.
Well, actually, often does come from a word oft. in which the T was pronounced.
Like oft times.
Oft, yes. And in modern times, we haven't pronounced the T, which isn't unusual in English when you have two consonants. Often one of them falls by the wayside. In the 19th century, that often pronunciation was revived because people felt that to speak correctly, you had to say every letter in the word, which, of course, is ridiculous because letters get into words in unusual ways.
That would be hard with the word through, for example.
Yeah, that's another story. But there's nothing wrong with pronouncing the T in often. It is an acceptable pronunciation, but it's by no means more correct than without.
We go now to Tom from New York. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, I've always been curious about the origins of the term push the envelope. Just hard to understand why it means what it means.
I wish I could answer that for you. I have a question about that pending that I haven't yet got to for my blog. But as I recall, it first arose in either the space program or the test pilot.
Pushing the sound barrier.
Maybe that's what it was. But I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
There are some things that perhaps somebody just said and everybody liked.
Right. And sometimes these catch on because they sound trendy, and the feeling is this person knows something I don't. So if I start speaking the way he does, I will sound like I know things that other people don't. I'm pushing the envelope a little bit there with that explanation. But I think sometimes that's the appeal of trendy, unusual locutions.
We go now to who's this person? Nick from Manhattan. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
And what's your question or your comment?
Well, with the Yankees in the World, with the Yankees in the World Series now, you hear a lot of people talking about their success in Game Sevens or Game Sixes, and I wonder if the plural of that phrase would actually be Games Seven. Just like attorneys general were
right.
Holding one.
Believe it or not, I was asked this same question that last year. And it seems to be that we treat a phrase like game six as a singular compound noun. And to pluralize it, we make it game sixes.
Okay.
You'll find this over and over again if you Google, say, Google game five. You never find games five. It's always game fives.
Right.
They did
right.
well in their game fives. Or the Yankees often do well in their game threes, but fall off a little in their game fours.
Of course, I don't always trust the grammar of the guys on ESPN, but I guess I'll take your word for it.
Well, they're shouting so loud, it's hard to miss it.
That's true.
Thank you for calling us. We go now to Jimmy from Bayhead, New Jersey. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I'm okay.
I'm curious about, I do a lot of texting and substitute or shorten or make up words almost to save time. And I'm wondering if children who use cell phones now and do a lot of texting are going to almost be learning two different languages, the language and the spelling in school. And then the spelling that they use on their text messaging. And,
well,
and quickly, point two, I live in a resort community, and the post office is closing. And I said, well, why is that? And the fellow said, because nobody writes letters anymore. They text each other.
Oh, well, I don't know. I think that the post office is having a push to close a lot of small-town post offices. They're threatening that in my town in Connecticut. And I don't think any less mail comes in, frankly.
Right.
But I, as far as your earlier question, I think it's my feeling that kids have always learned multiple languages. In my grandfather's time, kids spoke one language on the street, and they spoke another one to grown-ups, and they spoke another one in school. And I think that this is the same kind of phenomenon we're seeing with the language of texting and the language in real life. Kids always seem to learn different languages. My mother, for example, spoke beautiful English, but after she died, I found her diary that she had kept for 5 years in her teenage years, and it was all weird slang and shorthand and weird teenage talk from the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And so she obviously knew two languages. So I think the kids are going to grow up the same way.
I think we're always bilingual in that way. Mm-hmm. We know there's a private language that people have
right.
amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this often happens within ethnic and racial groups as well. But
yeah.
it happens with people of different generations. I can mm-hmm. say certain things that will make a younger person laugh because there's so much of my time and mm-hmm. They're now passe and the kids have a whole other thing that I have to learn.
Right, right. And
my bad, for example.
Sure.
You know, I always thought...
Right, and I know
my
when,
bed was a bad way of saying the thing you're sleeping in.
Right, when I grew up, kids played on playgrounds. I don't know if they do that anymore at recess and at before and after school. And there was a playground language, mm-hmm. a language of play, that and you knew where you were. You knew when it was time to switch languages. So I wouldn't do too much hand wringing about the language of texting.
Patricia T. O'Connor is my guest, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org, and we will be back with more right after this.
Three little words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase.
Carmen McRae. I'm here with Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're talking about the language and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And, Pat, you get an awful lot of email from our listeners
mm-hmm.
off the air. I
oh,
mean,
yes.
Well, obviously off the air.
Right.
But people who are inspired by the show
uh-huh.
to want to talk more about the language. What are some of the other interesting things that you have received in the last month?
Well, this one, I got such a kick out of this one because a listener named Edward wrote and said, Pat, I just read an article in an IT trade magazine wherein the author used the word inkle, I-N-K-L-E, as a verb, meaning to imply or to hint. And he said, this can't be right, can it? Well, I thought, inkle, what a cute verb. But anyway, it turns out this was one of those eureka moments. In the 1300s, there was actually such a verb. To inkle meant to communicate something in an undertone or a whisper, or to hint at it, or to give a hint at something. And later, this verb, inkle, gave rise to the noun inkling, to have an inkling of something. And that meant it meant a slight mention or a subtle intimation of something. Meanwhile, the original verb, inkle, fell into oblivion, and it vanished for several hundred years, but it was reinvented in the 1860s and again around 1900, independently, as a back formation from inkling. A back formation is when part of a word is dropped, as in, we got escalate from escalator. Well, we got inkling, we got inkle from inkling, but it actually had been an obscure medieval word, and it was reinvented. And now it seems to be that it's being reinvented again. It keeps being reinvented as a back formation, and essentially it came before inkling. So it was just one of those little eureka moments for me. I think to inkle is a wonderful verb, don't you?
I do, although I don't think I'll ever use it. But this is one of the reasons we keep the OED around. It
right.
tells us that there are words like inkle.
Right. And I'll never think of inkling again without thinking of inkle.
A listener from Clinton Hill, Christine, says that Pushing the Envelope was first in print in Aviation Week and Space Technology. So obviously
mm-hmm.
we're on the right track, so to speak. Or at least in the right area. A listener, Kimberly from Norwalk, Connecticut, wonders, could you suggest a plain English alternative to the word incentivize?
Incentivize. Well, how about influence? or reward.
Or you could just change the sentence. You could say, as an incentive, blah, blah, blah. What's wrong with that?
Right, or give someone, I'll give you an incentive to do this rather than I will incent you to do it.
Okay, I hope that helps. Danielle from Northport, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My grandmother, often when I was young, she helped in raising me, would use a term, you're a pain in the badai-dai. And I'm wondering if we've heard of this word, if it's a real word, and if so, where would the roots to that word be?
I don't have an inkling.
I could inkle that badai-dai for her was probably a made-up euphemism for butt or whatever. Grandmothers are famous for using euphemisms for things because they don't like to use bad words in front of their grandchildren. So lots of people's grandmothers have interesting euphemisms for these things.
Well, it's funny. It's one that has passed down now because she said, I've asked her about this word several times as I've started to use it with my own children.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that one of her great aunts who raised her from Ireland must have brought it with her. But so we're thinking it's a made-up word.
Yeah, it probably is.
Well, thank you very
Although
much.
We could always check the OED and find out.
Maybe how would that be spelled?
Maybe it's Old English. But you know what?
Old Celtic.
Steve from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My wife and I are constantly arguing, and all my Yankee friends are arguing about whether it is Hey Yankee fans or Hey Yankees fans.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it both ways on CBS, on their home network. Probably both are okay, but uh-huh. I figured it was fitting with going into tonight if we can get a clarification on am I a Yankee fan or a Yankees fan.
Actually, well, I'm a Mets fan, so I would assume that it would be a Yankee.
There are actually two schools of thought because this is another question I've gotten, and I tend to get it around World Series time. But the predominance of the evidence is for the plural. And if you go on the Yankees website, the Yankees official website, they use the term Yankees fans. So they use the plural Yankees as the adjective. And it seems more right to me because we don't say Met fans or Red fans or Giant fans. We say Giants fans.
I guess the important thing is that as long as you're not a Philly or Phillies fan, then that's what's most important.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your call. I always think that a Yankee is a singular, like a Yankee in King Arthur's court.
Right.
So Yankee fan might be somebody who liked a Yankee.
Yes, but as far as a member of the team, the Yankees, I think you speak of them in the plural.
Joe from New Jersey left a comment on our show page. He said, occasionally I hear or see the word outlier, which I presume means an item isolated or separated from similar items. I don't recall ever coming across the word before the turn of the century.
Maybe we have Malcolm Gladwell to thank for that. The word outlander and the adjective outlandish are very, very old, and they mean someone from outside the immediate area, a foreigner. And I think outlier is probably a variation on that theme.
It's interesting you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell. The popularity of his book has brought that word into common usage. And a number of listeners have pointed out that Tom Wolfe made pushing the envelope part of the language. I guess if you write a bestseller and you have colorful language, people will pick it up. And even if you didn't invent the word, you wind up being the person who's the Johnny Appleseed of the word.
Oh, right. Well, Tom Wolfe is responsible for quite a few. Remember the social X-rays from, I can't remember the name of it. And the one about mau-mauing the flak catchers, that essay, that had quite a few nouns that entered the language.
Well, Shakespeare did it before.
Yeah.
And we should not complain about this.
No.
If they're useful.
Right.
We can slip in another call. Byron from New Jersey, how you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think it's Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yes.
The book you were
it just popped into my head. Thank you.
My simple question is, I've always wondered about the origin of the word enough.
It wasn't originally E-N-O-W?
Yes,
I've seen
world
it written
enough.
That way.
Yes, yes, E-N-O-U.
It gets shortened and misspelled to E-N-U-F, you know, sometimes.
Right, right.
But it's just always, it's one of those English words that's kind of really strangely spelled.
I would guess it's from Old English and comes from Germanic sources rather than from the Latin strain.
Most of the words that have GHs at the end do,
yes.
Don't they?
Yes, and oddly enough, though usually they were once the GHs were pronounced. Now, words that came to us from Middle English with O-U-G-Hs and A-U-G-Hs basically went in two different directions. They either became silent, as in daughter, or they became F sound, as in laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And people sometimes say, why do daughter and laughter look exactly alike? Why don't they rhyme? Well, at one time they did. So it's very interesting, those histories of the O-U-G-H words.
Thank you so much for calling us. We have pretty much run out of time, but a reminder that if you want to put a question to Pat directly, you can email her at mailbox@gramophobia.com. And you can also go to gramophobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners, some of which have inspired her books. And do you want to go through the list of the books?
Woe Is I, You Send Me, Words Fail Me, Woe Is I Junior, and Origins of the Species.
And now Woe Is I has just been issued in an updated and expanded edition.
Third edition, yes.
And we look forward to seeing you November 5th, the next time you come by to talk with us on the show.
November 5th?
So I know nobody.
25th. Something like that.
On tomorrow's show, George Steele, artistic director of the New York City Opera, on the company's upcoming season. And then the acclaimed Norwegian pianist Till Fellner will perform live in our studio. Also, John Irving on his new novel, Last Night in Twisted River. Plus, our latest underreported series looks at two different sides of algae. On one hand, new research links algal blooms to mass extinctions, while cutting-edge science is using the green slime for biofuel. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn and Stephanie Bernhardt. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.